This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. As corporate-owned grocery stores that run on thin margins pull out of urban neighborhoods, residents with limited transportation options and limited buying power find themselves left with only one option, the corner convenience store, with high prices and highly processed foods. The result is spreading urban food deserts. Civil rights advocate Jesse Jackson was recently in Cincinnati to demand that the Kroger Company develop alternative urban models. Whatever happens with that strategy, a variety of local activists are taking action now. I'm joined today by the founder of Brick Gardens, Dominique Peoples, who won a People's Liberty grant, people spelled two different ways there, in 2016, that led him to develop vertical farming concept and introduce it to Cincinnati. Dom is joined by the founder of the Ohio Food Connection, Elise Chalmers, and the head chef and owner of La Soupe, Susie DeYoung. We are also joined by executive director of the Lloyd Library and Museum, Patricia Van Skyk. The Lloyd has just opened a new exhibit entitled Garden to Table, Traditions and Innovation. In conjunction with that exhibit, the Lloyd is sponsoring a speaker series that features all of our other guests and more. To join our discussion, you can call 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. So welcome, everyone. Pat, let's begin with you. The Lloyd Library, which sits right on Plum Street, just north of Cincinnati City Hall.
Right.
Everybody has seen it. Lots of people haven't probably gone in because they weren't quite sure what it is. Very modern-looking building, but with a very old and interesting collection. How does the exhibit you're doing sort of connect to all of these other food elements? And what do you bring to the table?
Well, first of all, we are a plant-based library, so almost everything in our collection springs from something to do with plants. We were founded by three brothers, the Lloyd brothers, who developed plant-based medicines in the late 1800s. But we continue to add to the collection. Our collections today go back to the 1400s, and they come all the way up to the future, or the present, actually. We plan for the future. One of the things that we do, not just with our collections, but our exhibits and our programming, is they're collection-based, but that's just a springboard to things that are relevant and issues that are contemporary and important to today.
One of the things I want to sort of make sure you mention, that some of those the books and some of the materials you have are really not just incredibly interesting in terms of the information they have, but the artwork that can be displayed in terms of the plant life, and are absolutely beautiful of what you have in your collection.
They truly are. And what's interesting is we have almost as many artists that use our collection as scientific researchers.
So yeah, it's so if you haven't been to the Lloyd, this is a great reason for both the content of what the exhibit is and also just it's a fascinating collection. Dominique, you know, certain neighborhoods in the city have been characterized as food deserts, and I gave a very shortened definition of that. What does it mean for a neighborhood or a family that lives in a neighborhood that is a food desert on a day-to-day basis? What are the practical implications of that?
It changes the choices that you have to make. You know, I'm fortunate enough to be able to get in my car and go to a grocery store that's outside of my neighborhood. A lot of my, a lot of my neighbors, they didn't have that same convenience. So it dawned on me that, you know, no one should have to worry about or make a decision about where they get their nourishment from. You know, a lot of people in my neighborhood don't have access to transportation, so it's not as easy for them to go outside of the neighborhood to get the fresh vegetables that they want. And that shouldn't be a choice that somebody has to make to get up and decide, okay, well, I can get on public transit and I can go to a grocery store. That can turn into a 3 or 4 hour trip, and the grocery store may be 15 minutes away from your doorstep. That's unacceptable because a lot of people will decide to go to that corner store that has food there. It's not the healthiest food. It's preserved. It's stuck in a can. And that's the choice they have. Or it's fried. And that leads to so many other things that could be detrimental to a neighborhood.
And the prices in those corner stores, I mean, if you go to an occasional corner store because you're picking up gas at the same time, that's one thing. But if that's what you're dependent on, it is extremely expensive and the food quality is extremely low.
Absolutely. So you're paying high prices for stuff that doesn't even have the nutritional value that you're looking for. And you have to make that decision whether or not I'm going to buy something that's cheaper but less healthy than being able to buy whatever scarce produce these corner stores may provide.
Elise Chalmers, you're the head and founder of the Ohio Valley Food Connection. What are you bringing to this? What's your approach on this sort of healthy food, local food issue that we're talking about today?
Well, I'd like everyone to guess how much of the food that's eaten here in the Cincinnati area comes from this region. And it's very little. It's under 5%. So my mission, my passion, is to make it easier and more accessible to more people, including in the food deserts, because we've got an amazing agricultural industry and history here. We've got farmers that work very hard to grow things. So our mission is to make that connection easier. That's why connection is in our name. So both by providing both for households, institutions, schools. There's the Farm to Cafeteria Conference this week right now at Duke Energy Center, where thousands of people around the country are trying to make farm to cafeteria and schools more accessible. You know, with the Cincinnati Public Schools has, I think they do 20,000 breakfasts every day and 30,000 lunches. If we could get more local food into that program, how wonderful would that be?
Wonderful for who?
For the children, firstly, because we're talking about harvest to order. What happens when you get food from a grocery store? How long has it been since that food was harvested? What does that mean for the taste so that kids can actually appreciate fruits and vegetables, and the nutritional value that just goes down every day that it's been harvested, every day away from harvest that you are? So if you can get farm-to-table food to those kids, I mean, today farm-to-table has that connotation of, you know, an elite gets that farm-to-table. But it's easy. We want to make it easy for schools, for everyone to be able to do that. Another way is we have this household program where we partner with stores around the city, and households can have access to. We work with about 70 farmers around the region, all local. So you order online, and that's something that we'd have to work with corner stores, is how you do that if you don't have a computer. And then 2 days later, your grocery bag of all local appears. We do that now in Hyde Park, Covington, et cetera. We'd like to do that more in Food Desert. We applied for a grant with the Healthy Corner Store Initiative to do that. We did not get it. So if anyone is out there and wants to help us, we want to do this.
Anybody with a little extra money. Yeah. So, you know, when I was reading about what you're doing, I'm a historian by background. Pat knows this very well. We've worked together. It really reminded me of the original concept for Green Hills, which is one of the four Greenbelt communities that was built. And everybody thinks the Greenbelt was Winton Woods Forest, but that's not what it was. It was connecting the farmers who surrounded the village of Green Hills to the market, to households, and to markets in that area, and trying to stimulate not only good food for local people, but good outlets for farmers. And it seems to me you're trying to do that in a 21st century concept, the same way that the Greenbelt effort was trying to do it for farmers and local people. So it just rang really true to me that there's something really good about what you're doing.
Taking the logistics, taking the stuff that's a little bit hard in that connection and trying to make it happen.
Susie DeYoung, you have become sort of a legend already here in your own time.
Oh, yeah.
With La Soupe. talk a little bit about what La Soupe does and what you do what your approach to this whole situation is.
Well, first I'll correct you on my title now because I have hired an executive chef.
Oh, my goodness.
So this is big news for me. Jason Lauda previously had just been coming from Metropole, but he's who's running the shop right now as I sit here. Which has given me the freedom to do more of these things and make more connections and really spend more of my brain power in connecting the dots. And for us, it's about the food that perhaps Elise and the farmers have grown that didn't get sold. It's still been grown. And can we utilize that instead of letting them always turn it under? Which is fine. It is fine. But if we have another outlet for it, we've primarily targeted the grocery stores because that's where the primary amount of waste that we're seeing and the easiest for a pickup.
What kind of waste, you know, we all go to grocery stores. Where does the waste occur in the grocery store? What's getting thrown away?
Well, what we're picking up, I primarily look for the produce because it's got the shortest shelf life. And the pantries, the Free Store Food Bank, and other organizations all can use the shelf stable. That isn't the issue. It's trying to use it in a mindful way. And the only solution that we have as a chef, to me, is using our incredible chef community. So if we can get this food to chefs and ask them, beg them, probably more like it, to help us and take some of the produce, they produce the soups or the stews or the salads, and then we go back and distribute that to the different agencies that need help feeding their in-house clients. But then we're now going to 47 partnering locations that are literally the food insecure of our city.
Wow.
So we've grown it really very quickly because the need's so big and the waste is so much.
Dominique, I want to come back to what it is that you're doing. I ask you to sort of set us all up about food deserts. And I wanted to make the point, too, in that second introduction, food insecurity can happen for families who don't live in food deserts, but because of a variety of circumstances, they can be food insecure.
Correct.
Anywhere. What are brick gardens? And what is your vision here that you want to help people to address on their own terms some of these challenges?
Brick gardens is an idea. It's an idea around being able to provide your own food and to be able to extend the growing season. One thing that food deserts have in common is they have a lot of empty space. So one of the thoughts that I had around brick gardens is let's take some of that empty building space rather than just let it sit there. Let's make it look pretty on the outside and on the inside. Let's grow as much produce as we can fit in there. Vertical farming is one of those options. So we are doing a couple of things with that. We are attempting to help out with the food desert issue by providing produce all year round. So
when you say vertical farming,
right?
What does that mean?
So it's taking a very limited amount of space. We have shelving that goes 6 or 7 stacks high, and then we just grow produce on each one of those shelves. So it goes straight up.
And there is water?
There is water.
Water
they water themselves, actually. So what we're able to do is actually plant the plant. And then at that point, the system waters itself. So it's continually growing.
And then you have grow lights?
Grow lights as well. So it's the hydroponic ebb and flow vertical growing system. So most people that know what vertical growing is will understand what that means.
Right. And so this is something that you hope individual people could do in their own homes.
Yeah, absolutely. So we also work on a much smaller model. I have one in my garage. So I refuse to buy salad at any grocery store when I can just go downstairs and pick it myself the day that I'm going to eat it. And there's something in that. You know, it to me, it tastes better because I grew it. I know where it's coming from. And I don't have to go to the store and pay for salad anymore. So you get your money back within a couple of harvests, actually. So
when you say salad, you're meaning greens, lettuce, various lettuces.
Yes. So we've gotten really good at growing various lettuce mixes and different types of leafy greens. So kale, spinach, we've got the basil, which is really good because in Cincinnati, we're not getting basil from Cincinnati. So to be able to grow basil in my basement is awesome, because if you've seen the basil at your local grocery stores, it's probably been sitting there maybe 2 or 3 days, but it was on that truck to get here or that plane to get here for a good 7 days prior to that. So there's definitely a difference.
So this is an effort to get it really down to the individual level, even in an urban environment.
Absolutely.
Elise, another thing is you're trying to get local farmers to get better access to the markets, to individuals, so that something doesn't have to travel for weeks on the truck before it gets to the store and sits out for a few days.
Absolutely. It's, you know, the chicken and egg thing. So you have to have a market for farmers to decide to put some risk and money into growing more or growing outside of season. As
right.
You know, you can really grow things over the winter. You can get local things over the winter, but you need more infrastructure. You need hoop houses and irrigation systems and things like that. So by creating a marketplace, we hope to give farmers more economic sustainability, right? So mm-hmm. that they can thrive, land can keep in preservation, land can keep agricultural. They don't have to sell out to development. Not that development is bad, but is development good on good soil? Topsoil is a limited resource. The more we can protect that and keep it in agriculture, the better for everybody in the long term. So yes, we also, I want to mention, have a partnership with Green Umbrella. If you might have heard of the, it's an environmental organization that federates different organizations that have an environmental goal in mind. And with that, we got the Ohio Valley Food Hub project funded, which helps get training to farmers. So food safety training, things like that, that are required to get in local food into hospitals, schools, institutions like that. And that's an important part of growing farmers' businesses, is to get into larger volume clients. We have wonderful restaurants and chefs that have been buying local. Kudos to all of them, because they're really making the effort to do that. Now we'd like to also get into these institutions that can make a big difference for the farmer and for their employees.
We have a person on the line who has a question, and I think his name is Doc, and I think, Dom, I think he might know you. So, Doc, do you have a question?
Yes. What's going on, Dom? How you doing, brother?
I'm good, Doc. How are you?
Good. I guess my question would be, Dom knows I had a Heaven Harvest farm for a lot of years, and the problem that I had, organic farm, the issue that I was having was actually connecting with the various restaurants, I guess the marketing aspect. I grew lots of where, you know, it was just hard to farm and get the stuff to the
market.
And, morel mushroom honey and wild onion honey. I just wanted to know, how do you guys connect with the restaurants and with the communities? Like, how do you make that connection?
So that is a good question. I'll tell you how I make the connection. It's a guerrilla tactic. I literally got on the phone. I would try to figure out who the chefs are that really had an interest in buying local. And at that point, it's about starting a conversation with them. For me, it was telling them what I'm doing and why I'm doing it. And a lot of times you will get people that will support that if they believe in the value of what you're doing. So for me, it was a hard battle. It's a hard battle every day, but the more people you meet, the more people they introduce you to, and the next thing you know, you're fielding phone calls. And at that point, you're trying to keep up with the demand that's coming in. So be careful about how many people you tell and how quickly. But that's how I did it, and I'm sure some other people can offer some other.
Elise, some thoughts on that?
That's exactly our mission. So, Doc, is it?
Yes.
What we do is help connect farmers with the market, because we understand the issue of farmers having to grow and then market and deliver. Once you market, then And then you have to go back and have enough time to deliver. So the more you market, the less time you have to produce what you just marketed. It's a tough problem unless you get, you know, have a lot of money in the savings account to hire people. So our goal is to market for you, Doc, for people like you. So to connect you, we have about 150 wholesale accounts, and to connect you to those accounts and make it easy. So all you have to do is grow and tell us what you're growing, and hopefully some of our buyers will be interested in what you're growing.
Susie, you sort of have lived on the other side of that equation.
Yeah. I'll take anything. No, I don't want to take anything. But yeah, we have a lot of the local farmers that just know now that they don't have to turn it under, and that, you know, they thought they were going to not have a lot of kale, and now they've got a lot of kale, and they have a place that'll take it and utilize it as quickly as we can and get it to people in need. It's a win-win for everybody.
Yeah. My wife and I belong to a CSA, and one of the things when you first start getting that weekly box, which you don't know what's going to be in it from week to week, you didn't order it, you just got the box, you find out all these different kinds of greens that you would never have purchased if you only stayed in your own little rut, and you find out the magic of soup. And we have learned to anything can go into soup.
That's why we do soup. I mean, it is. We do laugh about the same thing, though, because it is every day for us. I mean, yesterday was like a mind-blowing amount of food. I think it was over 2,000 pounds in our 900-square-foot building that somehow magically, if you do a time-lapse photo, you would see how quickly it comes in, how quickly it goes out, because people, we've gotten the reputation now they can trust that it'll get used.
It'll get used. I think that's key for people. They want something good to happen.
Right. And I think with you and your wife is that you cook. What we saw a lot of is so many people have forgotten how to cook, have never learned how to cook, and now it's a generational thing. So bringing people back to the kitchen is really the ultimate goal. Like, grow it in your backyard, then eat it.
Or in your garage.
Or in your garage or in your basement. But learn how to cook with it and know what to do with it. And soup really is an answer that, I just laugh. I think we're all talking about going back in time. And that's what I've said time and time again. I think we're going back to the basics of, you know, Victory Garden kind of concept of life. But that would work.
Pat, one of the roles you're playing in your organization, the Lloyd Library and Museum, is playing in all of this, is sort of being the connector.
Sure.
And there's other organizations involved. I think of the Free Store Food Bank, both with their Giving Fields program, which is producing produce closer to the people that they are serving. And they also have now this truck that's going around on a regular basis to serve neighborhoods that are food deserts. So are there other organizations in town that through this exhibit and this process you've connected to?
Sure. The Walnut Hills Redevelopment Foundation is actually a partner in the grant, and we have an auxiliary exhibit that's called Gardeners Who Inspire. And it covers historic gardeners all the way through the present, pictures of folks in Walnut Hills growing their gardens. So the Redevelopment Foundation has been at the table from the very beginning. They helped us plan the exhibit, the programming around it. They were actually responsible for some of the speakers here today. And then also we're working in conjunction with the Civic Garden Center, who is our other partner. And they were founded as a Victory Garden. So we have not only archival matters and materials of theirs that are on display, but we have government reports, seed catalogs, all sorts of things from that same 20th century era.
Well, this is great. And unfortunately, we have to break. We have to stop. But that was the perfect transition, because the second part of our show is going to focus on Walnut Hills. So I want to thank all of my guests today. Susie DeYoung, who is with La Soupe, Dominique Peoples, Elise Chalmers, and Patricia Van Skyke, who is with the Lloyd Library and Museum. We'll be right back.
for listening to this podcast of Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our programs are available on the website, wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley.